just like this morning to give a general overview. I would just like this morning to give a general overview with regard to the meditation instructions since we arrived, remembering that there isn't any hierarchy. It's not a still can't hear. I'll soon be closer to it than an ice cream. Before I forget, because I will, groups 7, 8 and 9 are at 10:30. 10, 11 and 12 are at 11:45. So I'll just give the overview with regard to the meditation instructions over the days. Please note, of course, that it's not a developmental model. It's not a hierarchical model. That each of the practices, the meditations, are through your experience to see what works for you, what's helpful and valuable for you at the particular time. Or that we as the teachers can recommend is as comprehensive and as thorough and regular practice with the different meditations, so that they can be applied both here and in your daily life. And I'll also include a little bit about the comprehensive, full nature of the day. With the meditation instructions, when we began on the opening afternoon and evening and through on the first day, the primary instructions were mindfulness of breathing. And the intention, so important with everything in life, mindfulness of breathing, is that it contributes in a clear and direct way towards that bridge of harmonizing body and mind, to really feel the sense of well-being through giving full care and attention to the in-breath and the out-breath. With the in-breath and the out-breath, it's a valuable resource for relaxation, for the cultivation of calmness, for the dissolving, the dissolution of tensions and pressures. And there are situations in our daily life where you and I, we may be under some pressure, and sometimes the reaction to it can be anger or withdrawal or fear. And if we have a well-established practice of mindfulness of breathing, then quite quickly and immediately we can breathe in mindfully, breathe out mindfully, and stay calm and steady in the face of circumstances. And therefore, with our clarity from the mindfulness of breathing, contribute to dealing with difficult situations. And the mindfulness of breath is a really helpful and valuable resource. With the mindfulness of breathing as well, it's a reminder to us of change, in-breath and out-breath, breath coming and going, breath arising and falling, and bringing the intention to the mindfulness of breathing to really notice change. History, in fact, doesn't repeat itself. No two events are ever exactly the same. Nothing is ever duplicated in life. Nothing. And when we have a solid practice of observation, of mindfulness, of contact with the breath, one breath is never the same as the previous breath. The sensations generates are different in different locations, the feelings are different, the sensitivities are different. Nothing ever repeats itself. Life is a constant, diverse exploration. With the mindfulness of breathing as well, sometimes we need to make the breath a little bit longer and a little bit deeper. We need to be mindful of that when we lose contact with the breath or the space between the breath, how quickly the mind can wander and drift. So our practice is really being aware of mindfulness of breathing, but when we lose contact, where does the mind go? And of course that also applies in other situations, when in life, when interest drops off, when we're feeling tired, when we're not feeling close to or intimate with or connected, what happens to the inner life? Does it become bored? Does it become dull? Does it become numb? Do we slip into fantasies? Do we start generating stories, etc.? So we're deeply interested in contact with the breath, but we also want to be very clear with our inner life what happens when we lose contact with the breath. What goes on with us? It can be useful at the end of any period, sitting, walking, standing or reclining, to stop for a moment or two at the end of the formal meditation in any of the postures and just look back over that half an hour period, that 45 minute period, that hour period. What was the quality of presence like? Were we conscious human beings? Were we disconnected? How are we at the beginning of the period of the sitting or the other posture? How are we in the middle period? How are we at the end period? Sometimes our relationship to the posture, sitting, walking, standing, reclining, can be telling us a great deal about our relationship to many, many other events in life. Sometimes we come into the hall here and some people are very, 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 very slow to start and constantly looking for the perfect posture. But trust me, there isn't one. Sometimes others start off very quickly, strong determination. Sit down, start meditating. First period, very clear. Very good beginning. And then energy fades, interest fades, and the last half hour drifting away. Lost. Lost. God knows where. Not even God knows. Lost. There. And then other people, it's the last period of the sitting. For some, it's desperately waiting for it to finish. One didn't think one was a religious person and one starts praying. And finally the bell goes and there's huge relief. It's over. And the relationship to beginning, middle and end. How are we in the beginning of something important to us in life? How are we in the middle period of sustaining it in life? How are we when something important to us in life comes to its end, comes to its closure? And our practice and our exploration is finding the clarity and wisdom to deal with beginning, middles and ends. All issues of life, all the problems of life, are all about beginnings, middles and ends, about how we deal with things, how we deal with change. So sometimes our meditations can reveal a lot to us about much about our life, our whole attitude, especially the start, the passing through the middle period and the ending period, about anything. We then began to expand our attention to the body. This relationship to the body is a very, very, obviously, I hope, significant and important relationship. And it's a particular kind of relationship. Sadly and madly, we live in a world of real body obsession. and it shows itself in the bombardment of pictures and images and stereotypes of women and men, and of course children are very, very much exploited as well these days. We've become products, we've become consumers, we've bought the package, and of course with all of that it often inhibits clear relationship because we're just seeing the outer. And as the Buddha said, to use his words here, to see body in body. And what I mean by that, what is meant by that, sometimes we're just concerned with the outer picture of the body, ourself or other, size, weight, shape, colour, age, beauty, absence of beauty, all those interpretations that go on, and all those pictures and images about ourselves and others easily generate a lot of judgmental mind, forces of wanting and rejecting, attraction and aversion. We get pulled into all of this. Sometimes we see somebody, we've made up our mind about them just because of the way they dress, just because of a moment image that we have. We're not really seeing the person, we're just seeing the image that we've got of the person, and that really can immediately affect our behavior, our way of responding. So to see the body in the body is to go deeper than that, to go deeper than that superficial response. And in our practice, in our meditations, to see the body is to see it more clearly. To see it more clearly is to see the body is nature, the body is elements, the body is form, the body is vibrations, the body is cellular life, the body is a living being. So we're moving away from all the projections, learning to be closer to the body. It's not a teaching of withdrawal from the body, detachment from the body, quite the opposite really. It's a feeling of real closeness, and when we get past the images and see through them, of which the images about ourselves, how often we're engaged in approval and disapproval. One part of the body is a centimeter too big or too small, it becomes a crisis. Just because of a slight change in size. It's a madness in which we live. And we're just trying to see the body as the body. Express and appreciate body as organic life. And therefore, when we place our attention on the body, sometimes just experiencing the different parts of the body, sometimes just feeling the whole of the body, then we're genuinely very, very close to the body, very, very intimate with the body. It may be in that closeness and in that intimacy with the body, sometimes some real pain arises. Most of the time, for most of us, we know that if we just change the posture, the pain will dissipate very, very quickly. Not for everybody here. Some people have ongoing pain issues, no matter what the posture. And sometimes all the exercises and medication, sometimes there's still pain in the body, and it's not an easy experience to live with. In the turning of our attention to the body, in any of the postures, sometimes, as I say, the pain arises, and it's part of our practice to see if we can expand our pain horizons. We're becoming afraid of pain. As soon as there's pain, how quickly reactivity arises, how quickly we want to take a pill to get rid of the pain. We start to project our fears into the pain and build it up. And Dharma practice is a tremendous practice and a very effective practice to learn to handle skillfully pain. And if we turn our attention into the locality where there is pain, feel the outer edges, feel the center of it, see into it, checking for relaxation, noticing if any other part of the body is contracting at the same time. Sometimes in the resistance to pain, that resistance is putting pressure on the pain. Sometimes the pain ceases to be pain when we give it mindfulness and concentrated attention, and that pain just becomes an unpleasant sensation. Sometimes, through the power of the attention, it disappears altogether. Sometimes, as we get close to pain without the filters from it, of course it may seem actually stronger. But it's part of our practice to see if we can expand our pain horizon, and the body and the inner life will gain a lot of strength from it. In the working with the pain that arises there, sometimes we think all the pain I'm experiencing is completely physical and there's nothing emotional or mental about it. Sometimes that's the fact. Sometimes there is a huge amount of projection going on. We hardly realize it. We hardly realize that the mind is creating the pain, making the pain, building up the pain. One of the indicators sometimes for us is we come to the end of the sitting, we ring the gong, and immediately before the gong rang, one felt one was in the hell realms. So incredible pain, desperate for it to be over, feeling very tense. There's been some determination to sit and to not move. And then the gong goes, and suddenly one relaxes. Ah, the nightmare is over. One can move or whatever. The gong didn't end all the pain. One relaxed. One relaxed. And sometimes the experience moments before the gong is completely different to the experience the moment after the gong. Notice it. If it was just pain in the body, the gong is not going to make any difference. But if there's reaction, struggle, conflict, willpower, tension, waiting, impatience, all those states of mind are going on, and the gong ends all those states of mind, sometimes a huge amount of pain just disappears out of the body. Wow, how much my mind created here. So we use our practice to see clearly and to try to understand the relationship to the way we begin, our relationship through the middle, and the relationship to the end. We then expanded our attention, and just also with regard, in the overview of the day, the other postures as well. So the Sangha comes together, we meet together here, the regularity of the sittings before breakfast, breakfast to lunch, lunch to evening food, and from that time until the sleep. These are the four major periods of the day. And sometimes those four major periods of the day are rather similar, shall we say, in the daily life as well. How is our day? How is the totality of the day? So some people will say, oh, I'm a morning person, which always makes me smile. So you're not a person for the rest of the day, etc. So sometimes we're carrying a picture and an image about ourselves, and the self is fixed into a particular time of the day. But there's the whole of the day, the whole of the day. Life is really undivided. We can't divide life, but for convenience, only for language, no truth in it, just for language, we say morning, afternoon, night, and making that kind of language division there. How is our morning period from the wake up to the breakfast time? And some people find that the hard time of the day, and so there's some encouragement to do some exercise either in here or outdoors, and some people just hear the bell. And their morning exercise is turning over in the bed and going back to sleep. So can we find the energy in the beginning of the day? It's a new day. And let the energy move. And sometimes this is a practice and we can break out any pattern. There's the morning period. How is the relationship through the whole morning period? There's the meal times. And there are three aspects to eating of the food. One is what we eat. And it's important and valuable for us to eat nutritious and supportive food, which of course the guardian angels, the cooks, take great care of us with regard to that. There. And certainly diet and health have a very, very close relationship. Very, very close relationship, and it's worth being mindful and conscious in our day-to-day life with regard to diet. Second aspect of that is what we eat first, second, the amount that we eat. And in the amount that we eat, always leaving some space in the stomach so that the food can digest easily and it can be converted to energy. And it will give us support in the afternoon time. And I notice that as people get older, and I see this in myself, that, in the couple of decades ago or more, I was one of those who could pretty well eat as much as I like, and I still remained around 65, 66, 67 kilos in that kind of weight. As the passage of time goes by, the metabolism of the body slows down. So compared to what I was eating in my 40s and 30s, I'm probably eating probably half as much. And it's not that often I notice men and women are greedy or are just eating mountains of food and are putting a lot of weight, but are just simply still continuing to eat the same amount of food when the metabolism of the body years ago burnt it up more quickly. It's not that they're eating bucket loads of food, but one has to change according to the aging process, and if one wishes to keep for good health as much as possible. And all of that's part of our practice. What we eat, the amount that we eat, and the manner of eating. And one of the blessings of the retreat, because we're not engaged, at least the yogis, yourself, not engaged in talking at the food time, it gives us a real opportunity to really be mindful of eating, to taste the food, to feel the nourishment of the food, the blessing, and sometimes a little reflection. How many people worldwide, in the interconnectedness of the human family, are making it possible for us to eat? In the supermarket these days, I think it's unfortunate, but in the British supermarkets, the average item of food travels 1,500 kilometres. We need more local food, more food from a local area, more organic food, and to give support to all of that in our daily life, and to enjoy the food. Mindfulness of eating, to feel the taste of the food, and all of that's part of our practice. Part of a practice that human beings and organic life, food and diet, are very important for all of us. There's the afternoon period as well, and the evening time. Sometimes in the flow of the fullness of the day, something from within may arise. And the word vipassana, for many people, is associated with method and technique. But it, Dharma of the Buddha, has never been used in that way. Not on any occasion whatsoever. The encouragement is twofold encouragement. to meditate for calm and insight. The English word insight is a very accurate, very precise translation of vipassana. Vipassana, insight. Exactly the same meaning. So at times, there in our practice, we may need to put the priority sometimes on the calmness called samatha, on the calmness element, on the relaxation, on the reducing of the stress and the tension in all the postures, in the eating times, in the listening, in the one-to-one. And that may be a very important aspect. The contribution of calmness and relaxation, the reducing of stress, does contribute and make us more receptive to insight. And the insight and the calmness, samatha and vipassana, are the core foundations of meditation practice. So if we want to be more precise, we say we meditate for calm and insight. And make it a little bit more clear for you. People often will say, I'm coming to do a vipassana course. It's the common language, the common currency. But actually, we're Dharma teachers. Dharma teachers are genuinely concerned, of course, with the process of meditation, with the contribution of calm and insight for everybody. But as Dharma teachers, we're also deeply interested, share and explore a lot, many aspects of life outside of formal meditation practice. We're concerned with livelihood, we're concerned with service, we're concerned with language and communication, we're concerned with wisdom, we're concerned with our relationship to food and the environment and sustainability, we're concerned with our relationship with friends, with kindness and with love and compassion. And much of that very important activity takes place outside of the meditation cushion, outside of the form. So a Dharma teacher is a teacher who's looking at the whole aspect of life, exploring it in a whole variety of ways. One of those ways is the cultivation of samadhi, concentration and attention and mindfulness. So vipassana, you could say, or samatha and vipassana, calm and insight for meditation, is a feature, an important feature, but it's an aspect, it's a limb of a total body of teaching. And I mentioned this and just wanted to say this to you, so that we don't, as it were, put all the eggs in one basket, as we say in English. Not to imagine that by sitting on the cushion and walking up and down, it's the answer to everything. It's part of the exploration. And sometimes we need to share and look together at our relationship to work, our relationship to the arts, which is so important, our relationship to creativity, our relationship to love, our relationship to values, our relationship to the nation state, our relationship to our neighbours. And all of that is part of the discourse of the Dharma. It has a big vision. One aspect is being on a retreat, being in meditation, just to make it clear. We expand out our vision, our exploration. And sometimes, and this is important as well, of course, that in the sitting, walking, standing and reclining posture, in the form of that, there are periods, and they are lovely and they are precious periods, in which we genuinely feel a real sense of steadiness and calmness. And the element of steadiness in the human being is deeply important, and it's deeply important because it has a proximity to truth, and truth is steady. It's the truth which is steady is steady today, it's steady yesterday, and steady the day before. And sometimes in our steadiness, when we have no wish to be anywhere else in the world, we feel steady and calm and clear, there's a natural receptivity, a love and appreciation for silence can be in our steadiness, a stillness can be in our steadiness, and in that receptivity there is much to be discovered. And so it's not that we're trying to make ourselves absolutely calm and absolutely still, say through the whole of a sitting or the whole of a walking period, but there are some moments in it where it feels unusually calm, unusually silent and still. Sometimes the whole hall feels that as well. And those particular times are really precious times. Cognitions, our thought, may not quite comprehend what's so significant about the silence and the stillness. But often it does evoke a real appreciation of when it's very, very silent and we're very, very still. It touches some deep place inside of us, and it can give the opportunity for some release. Sometimes that release may be a lot of joy, happiness and gratitude. That's one form. Sometimes the release is suddenly seeing things clearly about oneself or about life or about an event in a totally fresh way in which we've never seen before. And suddenly we're really feeling, wow, I'm waking up, I was blind before. So in our silence and stillness, there's a receptivity that can bring out of us some incredible realizations, some real revelations, some extraordinary discoveries there. Sometimes in that depth of silence and stillness of the being, sometimes it releases stuff. That's the risk. Come here, you sit, you walk up and down, and sometimes in a single moment you think, wow, what's this all about? And there's a rush, feelings of anger or agitation. Yesterday evening Sandy was speaking to you about the five hindrances. What do they hinder? They hinder love, they hinder clarity, they hinder waking up, they hinder liberation. And sometimes these hindrances of wanting, that first hindrance, negativity, anger and blame, boredom and dullness, the third, restlessness and anxiety, the fourth, doubts and fears, the fifth. And sometimes people say, they report, they have a multiple hindrance attack. and all five hindrances are all fighting for a place in your consciousness. They think, God, all hell is breaking loose inside. Where did that all come from? There. And sometimes it's genuinely a bit too much to deal with. So of course, find the teacher, one goes to a group, one explores. But in a way, it's not easy. But the healthy aspect of it is that which was unconscious, that which was pushed aside, that which was neglected and forgotten, has a chance to come through. We need that inner space. We need that opportunity for things to come through that we can look at it. As long as it's outside of the field of consciousness, it just lurks around in there, somewhere in there, just hangs around. And then when it does arise, we're not ready to handle it. We're not ready to deal with it because it comes up and it often will land on somebody else or it lands on ourselves. But here we provide the supportive environment and a powerful environment for things to arise, things to move, things to be looked at there. And when something is there and we're facing it, a hindrance, two hindrances, all of them or whatever, there, then we know what we have to work with. Then we want to see, well, what's the insight? What do I need to understand here? What's the conditions, as I was saying last night, that need to change because the conditions make this experience happen in this way? If the conditions were not there, it could not arise. If a condition or conditions go, it collapses. And the whole principle, as shared with you yesterday, is on that kind of principle. Sometimes, as I mentioned, just finally again, when there's plenty of calm and steadiness with us, it's not so necessary to put our attention to an object as such. It's just establishing presence, and in that establishing of presence, allowing just a sense of presence there. And we can only encourage you through the rhythm of the day to make give full application. Wake up to breakfast, breakfast to lunch, lunch to the evening food to the sleep time, to the, so that we're kind of available to the whole of the day. And people who love the day feel the privilege of aliveness, feel the connectedness with the ordinary and the everyday. When that is there, there's very little interest for the mind to wander into the past and future, because the day feels so rich. And when we do go to the past and future, it genuinely, inwardly feels valuable to turn the attention to the past. There's something to learn from that, something to discover, some insight to come, and we need that. And I notice, and hopefully you do as well, that with regard to the future, even those who have to plan things, have to organize timetables, have to arrange programs 1 year or 18 months in advance, as it is for myself and other Dharma teachers, actually the amount of time that's required for planning, organizing, setting something in motion, whatever it might be about, actually is very, very little. Very, very little. And our relationship to the past and the future can be actually very, very light. And one of the key things to a very relationship to past and future, to making it very light and relaxed, is because of the intimacy which we share with the present. If our eyes and heart and ears are really, really open every day, the fullness of the day is very, very rich. Every single day of our life. And those who live fully and feel really, really connected, death is no problem. There's no problem. Death is a problem only for those who haven't lived.